Hello, thank you for having me. And thank you all for being there in the bar, as well as online. I got myself a beer, so I could pretend to be in a public space. But and I listened to you all read, and it was great. Thank you very much. I know my camera was off and my audio was off, but I was there. I was. So I think I'm going to read just about 10 poems. I think that will be last long enough. It's always a bit weird doing this online, so because I can't hear you, whatever, and or I don't know if I can hear people in the bar. Maybe I can, but yeah, there's always a bit of a vacuum feeling up to it, so hopefully it'll all go okay. So I'm just gonna read one from my second book, Drives, to start with, because I'm gonna read some poems from the radio after that, which have a similar sort of form and preoccupations. And then I'll maybe read some newer ones after that. So I'm just going to read a poem called F. Scott Fitzgerald. And one of the only reasons I'm reading it is because I still like it. And it's a sonnet, and some of the other poems I'll read are sonnets about writers, but they're all about me, obviously. F. Scott Fitzgerald. Of course, all life is a process of breaking down. You can live it up for as much as a generation, but as sure as the high of economic boom bursts like a bubble, ushering in depression. As sure as the shiny coin of happiness, oh, ecstasy to me, is spent at last. Fitzgerald shifts in bed. He has come west. His bedside locker slowly fills with empties. As sure as you get the girl and then get pissed, as sure as you buy the most impressive car, then drive it off the road. Out of the past, the long trains of our youth come snaking far off through the wheat fields. What we were straining for, Fitzgerald pauses, it was already lost. We'll be clapping a lot. Well, you don't have to clap. Yeah. I like The Great Gatsby still, I think. Yeah. I also like Louis MacNeice. And MacNeice, of course, wrote a poem called Autobiography with the refrain, with the line, "My mother wore a yellow dress," not the refrain, about his own mother, who was taken into hospital when he was seven and never came back, died, well, eventually in there, but, after being institutionalized for a while. So I wrote this thinking about that. After I had a baby, just one, just the one. So it's called Yellow Lullaby. A spill of sunlight and a yellow dress, a yoke, a yellow flower, a candle flame, a moth light moonlight in the nursery darkness. Every time my daughter cried, I came barreling out like some semi-deranged trainee barista, friendly but perplexed. And in the dark of night, lo, I was there, perplexed and ratty when she cried again, and thereafter on each new occasion that she cried. The form, the limb that moved, the light that shone, the hand that soothed her and the flesh that fed, the voice that wasn't silence that replied there in the night. So she was not alone, not talking, I mean, with the unborn and the dead. And my beard's got a goal, so I'm all around the country further. Anyway, but this is called The Brontes and another sonnet, and it's well, Bronte was the Bronte's real name, or Pronte. I'm sure you all know that, but if you didn't, I'm telling you. So their father made up their name and put an umlaut over the E in a kind of self-invention, which was successful when you think about it. And he was originally from South County Down, of course. Say, of course, that these things, I don't know, you might know that and you might not, and that's fine too. So yeah, that's really it. And Emily Bronte, well, all of the Brontes died very casually, It's a bit grim, sorry, in the pandemic year, but they did all die without much ceremony. So Emily kept claiming she would see the doctor until perhaps an hour before she died of tuberculosis, and died on holiday and was buried there. I didn't even bring her back. She just came home and told them she's buried there. Where's Anne? She's died. We buried her in Scarborough or whatever. And Branwell died of a sort of hangover or drug. Well, it's actually true. No, he did. He did. One of his, I think his last words were, "Oh, come quickly! I am dying. He's going, I'm dying." And then he realized he actually was dying. Sean had actually died of morning sickness, bizarrely, but like off dehydration. Anyway, that's all very depressing. But yeah, I don't know why I even mentioned. But yes. Sudden death, and it's well, I think when I wrote this wasn't really a phenomenon anymore, but as somebody who's yeah, I've had my moments. So the Brontes and Elegy. Okay. Let not have any more poems on the Brontes. No, none of the weird sisters toiling in the gloom to fan some inner flame. A grim al dente gruel might cool nearby. No lamp, no tomb-like interior filled with what moor-wide minds. And the father, kind and peculiar, let him drop. The son, too lone and lost, and all that doom, cawed as their umlaut, reboot, reboot, Photoshop, in particular, the grating nonchalance with which each contrived of some retro malaise, quite without warning, to be presto dead inside an hour. As Emily watched dance the cherry tree, the autumn sun's low rays, and all right, get the doctor now, she said. Sorry, that's a bit depressing. Have lots of sisters, that's really essentially what I'm, and grew up in the middle of nowhere with a very strange father. This is about my strange father, who was always strange, but really got very strange. Well, he had Alzheimer's disease, so in fairness, that was to be expected, but he had it for a long time, and I wrote this after he died, though I think I had begun writing it long before, because, well, he got Alzheimer's before people, everyone got Alzheimer's, which was, so one of the only people I ever heard who'd written about it, or first wrote about it in a literary way, was Jonathan Franzen in an essay from How to Be Alone, but it was published about 2000, about 20 years ago. And he was describing his own father's decline from Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. And he wrote this, which I must have written down somewhere. Well, I kept the article, not above. Anyway, right. The human brain is a web of 100 billion neurons, maybe as many as 200 billion, with trillions of axons and dendrites exchanging quadrillions of messages by way of at least 50 different chemical transmitters. The organ of which we observe and make sense of the universe is, by a comfortable margin, the most complex object we know of in that universe. And it is, I suppose. Anyway, sorry, I forgot the most complex object we know of in that universe, and yet it is also a lump of meat. I wish he'd had a heart attack instead. I actually didn't wish my father had had a heart attack. I think that's probably why I wrote this. I was rather glad to be there, I think. So, anyway, but I used part of that to write this, and it's a villanelle. I absolutely despise villanelles as a form. Please believe me when I tell you I will never write another one, but I don't know, it just happened. It didn't. So, Alzheimer's villanelle. Sorry about the villanelle, but I wish he'd had a heart attack instead, Jonathan Franzen wrote about his father, of the slow, quick, slow disease that left him dead. After they fished his brain out of his head, post-mortem, weighed and chopped it up like liver, I wish he'd had a heart attack instead. I wish he'd stopped at once. The doctors read the small, clear signs, that little tissue sliver of the slow, quick, slow disease that left him dead. Imagine a train delayed, 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 that pulls up without passenger or driver. I wish he'd had a heart attack instead of that spectacle. Our efforts round the bed to cheer like some incongruous bon vivant off the slow, quick, slow disease that left him dead. But did we? Had my father's soul quite fled? I cannot say for sure, though no believer, I wish he'd had a heart attack instead of the slow, quick, slow disease that left him dead. It's a typo in my book, which I've never noticed. There you go. Sorry, that's the end of that. She clearly was obviously rather more pissed off about all that than I ever realised when I read it. So, it's a long time ago now. I'm going to read a couple of the poems towards the end of the radio. One's called "The Fish in the Berlin Aquarium," and one is called "Poem in Homage to Built Things." Built Things in Three Dimensions. The Fish in the Berlin Aquarium. I was in the Berlin Aquarium about 7 years ago this time of year. And I like fish a lot, mainly because they can't talk or make noise, I think, actually. But also, I like the really big ones. So I like the big ones that look up like this, at a like that. And they're so uncanny and fantastic and unknowable, and I don't know what they know, and we don't know what they know. They could know more than we know. I suspect there's more going on really there. Neurons and dendrites and axons and so on, we don't know. We eat them. I still eat them. I feel bad about it, but I eat them. But it's actually not about fish, sorry, at all. It's it's about Well, I suppose it's about social media. It's a big one. It's like, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, figure it out yourself. But to be honest, it's about social media, and it's about living life online. And I quite like living life online, to be honest. But that's my fault. Anyway, the fish are symbolic, is all you need to know. The fish in the Berlin Aquarium. We had come to the Berlin Aquarium in the dead of winter. The Tiergarten snow-cold and monochromatic, some slanted alpine light turning a few of the upper windows gold. Inside, in the dreamlike corridors, we press towards the vivid turquoise tanks to see the grouper and Napoleon fish. They drift serenely from synthetic banks. Out of the wrecks of history, small domes and moulded caves, such ersatz shrunken worlds, the fish drift up, placid, one then two. They are large and fantastic as marine balloons and have oddly upholstered looking pearly heads, the surgeon fish and the gigantic race, staring with rimmed eyes blank beyond our eyes. We move our fingers over the cool glass as though to tap into their element, which is clear and pale, blue and perpetual, like some outrageous Scandinavian dusk framed and airbrushed. The fish are hyper-real, high definition almost in this space, and lift their bladder shapes through watery air, working the fleshy trapdoors of their mouths. Each moves its mouth perpetually in prayer and seems to be mouthing, "I am, I am, I am," at intervals. We wonder what they know, performing their status unselfconsciously, organically, intent, and if this slow mime of their movements just beyond the glass makes them really beacons of bright calm beyond the faces they present for us, or mutely harrowed in their comfort zone. That is the end of that poem. And poem in homage to three built things in three dimensions is about what it seems to be about. I'm not even three dimensions in this reading. But then I wasn't on the book either, and I'd probably rather encountered in the pages of a book than in real life. I am nicer in real life, actually. I'm much nicer in real life, but I'm better in the book. So I missed stuff in three dimensions. I missed it a lot over the last couple of years. But I guess this is where we are now, so it's fine. Goodbye to all that. Although I am strangely angry in this poem, I think actually. Poem and homage to built things in three dimensions. Sunlight yellow on an upright gable, standing by waste ground, a bright autumn sky behind it, and a foreground of low rubble transforms place into geometry. The nice arrangement of adjoining planes, almost like a work by Malevich. Here are the big quotation marks of cranes, train tracks, tram lines, suddenly a bridge staked out foot by foot over the river, form as a virtue of necessity, tensed suspension cable, cantilever and canyon. I like these relics of industry. I like warehouses too, the heartfelt views from high loft windows onto square grey yards, old balconied apartments in Cadiz, in cobbled streets, marble, misericords under the seats of medieval churches, bombed to just the naves, their empty shells deep and rectangular like lidless boxes. Anywhere weed grows on windowsills or structure finds its guarded heart exposed, for we shall give up what's interior. A townhouse on our route that has been raised, except two corner walls, frayed wallpaper, or mills slumped by canals, the struts and stilts of factories rusting back to skeletons, and broken open cupolas and vaults, gudgeons, anchors, hoopings, stays and chains. For all of this, we're pleased to see convert to something else, in a bright heaven where, held on the open network or closed circuit, are brilliant concourses or light and air with building block and freight of one and naught, for wagon after wagon of fast goods, experience itself perhaps pure thought or pure potential. Icons, wingless birds, flitting with ease across limitless space, all that is instant and intangible. Transparent bills hung on an interface, transparent too. So on that gable wall, were some forgotten manufacturing sign, take courage, say, try, even if you don't, remains in place. We smile to see sunshine on crumbling brickwork and on faded paint. Read a few poems from this, and they're all shorter. I guess like rhyming, it's really hard, and nobody notices or cares. That's fine. So this is called Silent Valley, and it is Silent Valley. I'm seeing the Mourns. It's one of my favourite places, actually, in Northern Ireland. There only are about four, so. But it's allegedly no birds sing there. It's supposed to be silent because there's no birds singing, but actually birds sing absolutely all the time. So that's not true. But it's not really about, it's more about just maybe before locking down before lockdown. Lockdown before lockdown. So this is what that's about. Silent Valley. Silent Valley stands in the Mourns, its brimming reservoir ringed by mountains, reads the information on the tourist app. The air is soft up here in the Paleocene, a little rock shining through heather with the patchy effect of flock wallpaper, a little breeze on the water's skin, a little bird rather controversially sings. Then we make our way down by the man-made wall that it runs for 22 miles of self-exhumed granite, as Zarathustra descended to the Agora to become generally disillusioned with the calibre of his followers. This is a bit similar, this one. This is called The Small Boat Had Turned. Actually, they don't even have titles. I just realised that it's just the first line I'm reading there. This is actually, I wrote this after hearing about Matthew Sweeney's death. So not far from you there. But, I can see myself on the screen in the bars. Notice that. When I heard about it on a boat, I heard about it on, I'm sorry, it's really inappropriate because I'm talking about somebody's death. But the poet Matthew Sweeney, I think about three people text messaged me when I was on a boat sailing from, I can't remember where you go now, is it Lewisburg? to Clare Island, or it wasn't Clare Island, maybe it was another island. Anyway, I was somewhere west going out to an island, and I thought, even here, somebody's messaging me. So that's not a very constructive response to it. I was happy to know, but yeah, it's sort of a tribute to him, I suppose. The small boat had turned. The small boat had turned outward from the headland into the grey field of the Atlantic when my phone buzzed in my raincoat pocket. Another death broke on the networks. The mainmast swung like a metronome as we swayed and turned further into the wind. The back white wall was awash with emotion. It rolled downward endlessly in slipstream. One gull hung in the uncrowded sky as we kept on course for the island, away beyond the last beach and the long reach of call and response and tumult, to go where the word that breaks on the steady prow is ploughed back down to the undertow. That's the button. And I'll read one more, which is about a poet, sort of an idea of exile or disappearing, or the longing to disappear. And then we just moan about it. Disappear and then just moan about it. But I can't remember where it is. And this was for a friend of mine I visited, and then I'll just read one more after that. This is for a friend of mine I visited in France who lived in a kind of castle. I was kind of, yeah, she lived in a castle. And I mentioned two of the artists I mentioned, Vivian Mayer and Henry Darger. If you know, that's great. If you don't, that's fine. Or, you know, wrote, one was a photographer, one was a painter, but they were not known in their own lifetime and just did it for its own sake. And the art, just did the old art for its own sake, which seems sometimes maybe the best, it probably is the best way to do it, isn't it? So, the swallows in the courtyard. The swallows in the courtyard, the moonlight over the outbuildings, the footprint trail in the terracotta tiles left by a cat who stepped 2, 3, 4 times from the 16th century to vanish here. In silence and splendour, your mothering work sunk out of sight amid Norman woodland, fled from Armagh, Belfast and the smoke-filled galleries of the 1990s. Your exile and art made with salvage and eBay, thrift and inheritance, like Vivian Mayer's or the Vivian Girls of Henry Darger, sheltering beauty in the narrow space required to forge it. Such hierarchic privacy. We have our tea where a millstone rests and the willows sway, while around us the sans-culottes and conspirateurs ignite the periphery. And the last one I read is also about revolution, because we're in the revolution. Sort of, isn't there? And just to go back to the beginning, it's another artist or writer or, you know, like figure, artistic figure that you always write about people you revere or whatever. It's Nina Simone. I'm not going to lie. It's a documentary on Netflix. So watching it, I've always loved Nina Simone, but it was particularly after watching the documentary about her life that I wrote this. And I was remembering when I first listened to her, or when I wrote my first book. And I'm thinking about, yeah, thinking. I think hopefully she's having a moment, but Jesus Christ, she'll have one long for now. So, or at least proper recognition. Anyway, Nina Simone is singing. I mean, it probably seems like she did, but not enough. It's never enough. So, this is a bit long and then I'll stop, and that's me. I think that's half an hour. Nina Simone is singing. Nina Simone is singing in my solitude from the low amplitude speakers of a Sony Ghetto Blaster. In my solitude, the long fifth note extends, or rather extrudes, all along Leith Walk and down to the harbour, pinching its finger and thumb. In my solitude, it is 1999. Panic and mild disorder attend the rundown to the bugged millennium in newsprint and radio. In my solitude. Panic and wild disorder beset too your inner world, which is your whole world now, at least for a while. Since you elbowed away life's goals and contingencies, its early uncertain brawl, in order to sit here, overlooking a new city, attuned to the hot constructions of that selfhood, yes, and playing at solitude. A glass of wine stands on the writing desk. It glows and is burnished by the northern summer light. Set down this cup. Oh, drink not from this glass. I'm just going to have a drink. Hey. Young, irrepressibly thirsty former self, for what you call solitude is a yawning mouth into which might drop quarters, lengths, fathoms. And for all that talk of solitude's hot flame, don't you actually have both a boyfriend and a girlfriend? Love's engine roars in the very recent past. Its dopamine head is huge and shaggy with myth. And the loves of the future advance towards you, extending their rhizomes, connections forged across the synaptic gap as neuron seeks neuron through the mighty force, such as that which through the green fuse drives the flower of being young in unlonely solitude and of tending towards love's magnetic dyad, not to mention the matrix of child love and child devotion through which you will pass as through a wall of flame, and it will be years before you let them go. Oh, I let them go now. I let them go, all the Oedipal boys, to swim back upstream to the passenger seats of their mother's Ford Cortinas. And this last girl, my daughter, separated from me at the border of my body, at this threshold after eons, who returns now wearing her father's anger and odd socks, and who grows, yeesh, like a coneflower, steadily into the sun. In my solitude, I let them go, like Nina Eunice, who was fierce and bullyable, who clamoured for Marx and Lenin and revolution. Her genius fled from the long self-exile of home and marriage, of affronted professional pain, to France and Liberia, singing of solitude. Who knew in the triumph of exile self-possession, with its broken mirrors, with the fallen towers of the mind, how raw is the sunlight? What an awful thing is a rose in the singular world that is untransfigured by love. Very unhappy ending. So I'll go back to F. Scott Fitzgerald, because that's what that's from at the end. That's me. Thank you very much for having me.
Everybody.